Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. You can watch my videos on historyreviewed.com or search for any of them on historyreviewed.com. Hi there, Frederick. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on the show today.
It's awesome to have you on the show. You've been so kind to interview me several times. And yeah, maybe just also give out your web URLs and so forth.
I do a weekly show called Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club that's on Spreaker, and that can you can get to the show pages every Wednesday night. We call it Wacky Wednesday, from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern time, and that's at blackbird9tradingposts.org. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at Blackbird9, and see here, where else? We're also on both the iTunes now and Alexa. So you can just say Blackbird9's Breakfast Club to Alexa now, and we'll pop up. So that's where you can find me.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. That's great. And are you going to go to Gab at some point as well?
Yes, actually, I'm on Gab and Wrong Think. So both on Gab and Wrong Think, I'm just Blackbird Nine, with the, you know, Blackbird, like a crow is a blackbird, and then the number nine. And you should be able to find me on Gab and Wrong Think as well. In this type of what I call fourth generation asymmetrical warfare, you don't have battle lines anymore. You have battle circles. And so it's those spheres of influence out there. And also, you don't have a single point of failure. So if you have just one website and it gets taken down for whatever reason, you're cut off. But if you have a presence on all of these various platforms, it's much harder to silence the message or the communique, as we say.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. Well, Frederick, I want to talk to you about 9/11, because off the air, you and I had some interesting discussions about 9/11, and you mentioned something that I'd never really thought of before. You mentioned those cell phone conversations. Now, at the time, and there's another thing I might as well mention in this regard. There was a woman, and I'm trying to think what her name was. You probably will know her name. She was somebody who hated Hillary Clinton. She was a conservative. Barbara Olson, that's who it is.
Yes.
Now, Barbara Olson is one of the people who died on 9/11. And I think Barbara Olson is supposed to have also made a cell phone call. And these cell phone calls that came from the phone, that came from these planes before they hit the towers, were interesting. And at the time, just a little bit in the back of my head, I did think it a little bit strange that people phoned from planes. But I didn't think too hard about it. And I thought, well, the planes are a bit low. Because since then, I've also flown myself, and they make you switch off your phones when you're on a plane because they say it interferes with the electronics. But I didn't think too hard about these calls, but they had several of these calls. And then they said, well, there was this one call where all these patriots were saying, let's rush into the cockpit. And they suspected that these brave patriots maybe fought it out with the terrorists, and one of the planes crashed. I think that's one of the planes that crashed out somewhere. I'm not sure if it was out in the Midwest or wherever. But anyway, these phone calls from these planes were fascinating, and I listened to them and I took them seriously, and I didn't think too hard about it. And just like the towers themselves falling, I watched the towers falling and it seemed okay. You know, these towers are falling, and again, I didn't see any reason to believe that they couldn't fall. But as we've discovered, there are some very, very strange things about 9/11. And the more you look at it, the more you realize, good Lord, this thing is really creepy. Where does this come from? So I recall you and I having an off-the-record discussion where you said that you were something of an expert on cell phones and that those phone calls on 9/11 were impossible. Can you give me a bit of background and explain to me how you arrived at this?
That was one of the things about 9/11. Everything was a great story, but it was physically impossible. Now, my personal background is in engineering, and I went to college and university in the 1980, early 80s. Studying first, you go to basic engineering. So I was taking the same physics, statics and dynamics, thermodynamics, chemistry classes as the structural engineers, the mechanical engineers, even though I went into electrical and computer engineering and had a career in the IT industry. And so, just go on with my, background.
Yeah, carry
After
on.
school, I went to work for a think tank here in North Carolina. And for the listeners not familiar with me, I live on the east coast of the United States, in the great state of North Kakalaki or North Carolina. And we have a thing called the Research Triangle Park between our capital city of Raleigh and the university towns of Durham, which has Duke University, and also Carolina, Chapel Hill, or University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And then Raleigh itself has North Carolina State University, where I went. And between these towns, there is a research park where all the major players in the IT industry, the pharmaceutical industries, have a presence. So you have IBM, you have Cisco, you have Ericsson, you have Pfizer, whatever Pfizer group is calling themselves this week, GlaxoSmithKline, it's all these pharmaceutical companies, their research facilities. But one of the main research facilities is called Research Triangle Institute. And so I was their top engineer for a campus environment in the early 80s, which was an Ethernet deck equipment shop. And I also worked with the phone technicians. So I had a background both in computer engineering and also telephone engineering. And as a hobbyist, I'm also a musician and a sound man, sound engineer. And so I have a lot of background in audio and all the different ways you can do audio over different formats. And then I left there to go to work for IBM and their network hardware division, teaching on this new thing called TCP/IP and the internet, because IBM was introducing their first what we called a multi-protocol router. And then I went from there, I went to a company called NetEdge, which is a big competition for Cisco routers. And then I worked in Europe for a while outside of Amsterdam in the Netherlands at a place called Xylan, which had LAN switching technologies. Then I came back to the States in the mid 90s to go back to IBM because they had decided at that point to do away with their own hardware division, and they were going to retrain all of their staff and clients on Cisco gear. And so this was this big alliance between IBM and Cisco that Cisco was going to now supply all the routers and switches for IBM. So I developed these classes and labs on this new gear, getting all the IBM engineers able to pass their Cisco certifications. Well, it was during that time that somebody noticed me and said, well, this guy's doing good course development work, and he knows all sides of these new technologies, not just, you know, the computer side. He also knows the telephone side. He also knows the audio side, the multimedia side, the video side. And so a company out of Cary, North Carolina, recruited me to help them develop a series of classes on what we called third generation telephony. And so, not to get too technical, but first generation telephony is the old plain old telephone service. You know, you pick up the telephone, you dial the number, and somebody picks up their phone on the other side, and you have a conversation, then you hang up. That's first generation telephony. Second generation telephony was early cell phones, where basically if you were sitting perfectly still and there was a cell phone tower, you could make a phone, a wireless phone call from that cell phone. And then moving into third generation telephony, that was the idea of using a computer network and a telephone network. And, you know, not to get technical again, but telephone networks are called circuit switch networks, and computer networks are called packet switch networks. And so what we were doing was converging these two networks so that both voice and computer data and early multimedia would be able to travel over the same network. And this was called convergence. And there was this new thing called voice over IP. And so this was that big push into third generation. Now we talk about fourth generation, fifth generation. But I was hired by Global Knowledge to develop these classes on this convergence technology. And my clients were anyone from the manufacturers themselves, like Ericsson cell phones, Cisco routers, Microsoft software, or the big telco companies, AT&T, Sprint, Verizon. A lot of, you know, the European and, you know, South America folks might not be familiar with these companies, but these are big companies in the United States that most of them have a global presence. Also, I was working with the military contractors that needed the security applications of this new technology. So I was working with people like the MITRE Group, General Dynamics, RAND Corp, MITRE, you know, these type of agencies, as well as military intelligence, naval intelligence, the NSA, the FBI, CIA, the state police, SBI, and local law enforcement, as well as government groups that were moving this. So I was unique in that I always say I was backstage on 9/11, because one of the about corporate land, as I call it, is you get what I call compartmentalized, where you just have one little worldview, like you're just doing your job and you don't get to see the big picture on purpose. Yes. You know, only the higher ups get to see the big picture. You're very compartmentalized so that, you know, you can't jeopardize the operation. Well, because of my vantage point, I had that 20,000 foot view of these changes in the telecommunication industry at all levels. And when I was, you know, brought in to develop these classes, that's when I started noticing that something was very much wrong before 9/11. And that's the key thing that people need to understand, is the U.S. telecommunication grid was already being modified and put in place to carry out all of this illegal electronic surveillance before 9/11 happened. Because I always say there's, you know, several red flags for me when I was developing these classes. Is the first red flag was after 9/11, none of the intelligence agencies, the NSA, CIA, nobody requested any curriculum changes to my agenda. You know, this event completely changed the world, as we said. I should have had to do a complete revamp of everything, right? There were no changes requested. So that's a huge flag. Now, The other red flag was with the NSA, because remember, I was doing this at an international level, and different companies use different formats around the world. The two big signaling standards in the telephone side, it's in the United States, you have what's called a T1 signaling, which allows you to have 24 phone calls over this one big pipe called T1 span, right?
Okay.
But Europe and the rest of the world has an E1 signaling. Well, when I was approaching the NSA, I said, okay, I'm sure you're going to want the E1 standard, as the NSA is never supposed to spy on Americans. And this was
Oh,
part
really?
of, yes, and this, a little history lesson here in the United States. Back in the 1970s, the NSA, the FBI, and the IRS got caught doing illegal electronic surveillance on key people in America, especially politicians. So it's kind of like a revamp of what we're seeing today, or the same things we're seeing today in the United States. I don't know if you're keeping up with all of the Senate hearings going on, or congressional hearings going on right now, inappropriate FBI use of surveillance. Well, the same thing happened in the 1970s, and this became known as the Church Senate hearings of 1975, named after U.S. Senator Frank Church, who was one of the people who was being spied on by the FBI and the NSA and the IRS. And this resulted in what was called the Foreign Intelligence Act of 1977, or the FISA courts. And basically, the lines were drawn that the NSA was never, ever, ever, ever supposed to be spying on Americans, And so here, special courts were set up, called FISA courts, that if any telephone surveillance was to be done, it had to go through these courts. Well,
So they have to ask for permission in the court before they're allowed to spy.
that's the way the laws were written as 1977 in this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or the FISA
So
Act.
it's
Okay.
FISA.
Yes. FISA. You'll hear that a lot.
Okay, because in South Africa, we're supposed to operate on a similar system. That before they spy on anyone, they have to go to a court as well. Yeah.
Right. So I was shocked. And again, this was before 9/11, that the NSA wanted the T1 version of my classes.
Whoa.
So that, was the huge red flag. And then basically, what I was seeing was during the Obama president, not, excuse me, under the President Bill Clinton administration, we had what was called a CALEA Act, Communication Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, which basically mandated that all telecommunication equipment and computer equipment be provided with backdoor access, and they did this under the guise of fighting the war on drugs, that law enforcement needs to be able to have these abilities to get backdoor access to all of these switches. And this was a huge thing in the industry, that all of the equipment had to be compliant by certain dates. Manufacturers had deadlines to make their gear CALEA compliant. And so what I was seeing was this system that was put in under the banner of fighting the great war on drugs was being exploited by the NSA on US soil to do illegal electronic surveillance. Okay. And again, this was before 9/11. Now, the shocking thing is all the telecommunications companies were all going along with this, with the exception of one company called Quest, Quest. Their CEO refused to go along with the NSA on this, and he was saying the same thing I was saying, was that these systems were all in place before 9/11. Okay.
Yeah.
He got put in prison on trumped up insider stock trading charges, which everybody now agrees were completely bogus, but he was taken out. The corporate executive officer for Quest was named Mr. Joseph Nacchio, N-A-C-C-H-I-O, and he was convicted of 19 counts of insider trading for Quest stock in April 19th, 2007. But these were charges that were brought against him immediately. And he was very much outspoken up to this time about this NSA program. And of course, you didn't hear anything about it in the mainstream media, along with any of the other telecommunication whistleblowers like myself, you know.
Was he saying this for years afterwards? Was he continuing to talk about this?
Yes.
Okay.
But, you know, he's one of those people that you know, are not going to hear about unless you go looking for what he has to say. You know, this should have been huge news if we had real news. And that's the problem with our compromised mockingbird fake news.
Yes.
Is we now have, you know, six companies, six corporations that own 98% of all the media in the United States. And so it's like Jewish Talmudic Mishira law, if you're not familiar with that, where it's against Talmudic law. It's called whistleblowing law, or the Mishira law, that one Jew is prohibited from informing on the crimes of another Jew before a Gentile court. Well, what you see is, you know, if they own the media, then they aren't going to talk about the crimes of fellow Jews. And so you have this huge hole in the truth because of this policy. And so, like I said, this should have been huge news, but instead, this guy is, you know, reported as a disgraced CEO, and you shouldn't listen to anything he has to say, and we're just not going to talk about it. And that's that lying by omission that is so dangerous. You know, that whole, you're supposed to be telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Well, if you're dealing with cultural Marxists that don't even believe in the truth, all they believe in is winning at any cost.
Yes.
Then they're, you know, hot and loose with the truth, and definitely aren't going to broadcast anything that's going to incriminate them. And so this was the huge thing that was finally exposed as illegal electronic surveillance on American citizens in clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. And I always go back to that quote by Schopenhauer about all truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third is accepted as being self-evident. So once people like me, you know, finally got the word out that, yes, they are doing illegal electronic surveillance in the United States, they finally had to admit it. And then they turned around and passed what was called the telecom immunity laws, or more, you know, it's basically they revived revised the FISA Amendment Act, and it was called the FISA Amendment Act of 2008, where they went out and they forgave all of these internet service providers, all of these telephone companies that were taking part willfully in this illegal electronic surveillance. And what we were seeing was under Operation Stellar Wind, under Operation Trailblazer, Operation Prism, and several others, was that they weren't just targeting people. They were sweeping up everything. So basically everything that was put out there on either the computer side or the telephone side or the multimedia side was being swept up and sent directly to the NSA. And what's interesting there is I was trying to prove that behind the NSA backdoor, behind the telecom backdoors to the NSA, there was another backdoor that went to, you know, the most likely suspect for 9/11. In other words, Israel.
Yeah.
And that was what I was trying to prove when I got blacklisted. This was later confirmed in 2013 by Mr. Edward Snowden that, yes, indeed, the these telephone companies are spying on Americans. They're sweeping up everything. NSA has a copy of everything. And Israel has a copy of everything.
Right. So that's kind of where I'm coming.
Right. So on 9/11, like most people, I didn't see the first plane or the images on TV of the first plane hitting. A friend called my house to tell me to turn on the news. And that's when, you know, I became aware of 9/11 was happening September 11th, 2001. And so we're sitting there seeing these events unfold. And when I saw the towers collapse, I had a different impression because of not only my physics and statics and dynamics background, engineering background.
Yeah.
But as a young lad, engineer wannabe in we call elementary school or primary schools, that was when the World Trade Centers were being built. And this was going to be the marvel of the modern world. And so I knew how they were constructed. And I also know how, you know, commercial airlines are constructed. And when I saw the towers, you know, fall, and especially World Trade Center 7 that fell at free fall into its own footprint, and it was not hit by any aircraft. Yeah. My reaction was pure Southern dialect of, oh, hell no. You know, that is physically impossible.
So were you saying, oh, hell no, the same day or the day after already?
No, the day of when I saw the towers fall, it was, that can't happen that way, not on this planet. That might happen on another planet somewhere with different physics rules, but that can't happen. And then when they started telling the stories of the cell phone calls, that was when I did my, oh, double hell no.
Yeah.
Because cell phone technology in 2001 physically could not make those calls for a couple of reasons. First being just distance. Cell phone towers for 3G cell phone telephony were designed to go out, not up. So if you go back and look at the flight data of those four aircraft on 9/11 and look at when the calls were supposed to be made, what the altitudes were supposed to be of those planes, and I'm saying all of that data is very suspect because this is the biggest production ever. But if you go by their numbers, then there's no way a call could have been made even if the plane was sitting still right over a tower. The second problem is the way third-generation signaling works. And basically at that point in time, if you were stationary, you could make a phone call to a cell phone tower and the call would stay up. But if you were in a moving vehicle, moving from one cell phone tower to another cell phone tower, chances are the call would drop and you would have to reestablish the call to the next tower. The handoff technology, that's what we call, you know, moving from one cell phone tower to another tower without dropping the call. That was still in its infancy. It did not work very well, especially if you're going by towers with different service providers, because the way the networks were set up, the signaling just could not establish a call. You would be constantly trying to initiate the call to the next cell phone tower, but by the time the setup got established, you would already be out of range of that tower based on the velocity of the aircraft by their data for the calls to ever get set up, much less have these 10-minute whatever phone calls that they were reporting. So you had 40 phone calls on 9/11 that were physically impossible. Okay, so I always go back to the line out of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's book, The Sign of the Four, from 1890, and he quotes, "How often have I said to you that when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth." And so I'm sitting there looking at, okay, the laws of physics just got abandoned as those towers hit the ground in free fall in their own footprint. They didn't topple over, fall over. You know, they collapsed in their own footprint. So the laws of physics were violated. And those physical phone, those phone calls could not have been made. And so we were silenced. But eventually, what's interesting is the FBI then tried to change the story that, oh, well, it wasn't cell phones, it was the sky phones on the planes. And so that's a very different dynamic because you have these things on the planes at that time, which basically some planes were outfitted with these, what they called sky phones, whereas on the back of the seat of the plane, I don't know if you ever ridden a plane that had these? We used to use them all the time. I used to live at airports, you know. But basically, you would put a credit card in, it would release the phone, and you could make a phone from the aircraft using a different technology than cell phone technology to make a phone call. They were very expensive to make. And that's, they tried to transition to say, oh, well, the phone calls didn't come from their cell phones. Maybe they came from the sky phones. Well, the problem with that was when you looked at those particular planes, they were not equipped with the sky phones. And the person who did some just outstanding research in this area is Dr. Ray Griffin. And I don't see, he was one of the early David Ray Griffin, and he was one of the early 9/11 truthers. And he also was instrumental in exposing just how farcical these 40 phone calls were, but how important they were to the narrative of the 19 Muslim extremist hijackers that were carrying out this event. They were, if you take away these phone calls, you have nothing really to support the narrative that these 19 hijackers did this event, because the security, there's nothing from the airport security cams. And it's interesting that Israeli company ICTS was in charge of network security on all of those flights, if we assume that, you know, the planes are really what they say they are. You know, they're airports of origin. ICTS was the Israeli company that had control of those airports. There are no videos of these guys on the planes. You know, so Dr. David Ray Griffin, you know, very systematically says, what do you have if you take away these phone calls, especially the United 93? Now, the United 93 is the anomaly because it is the plane that did not hit its targets. On that day, if we take the official narrative, 3 out of 4 of these aircraft hit their designated targets. One hit the Pentagon, one hit the World Trade Center 1, one hit the World Trade Center 2, the other crashed over Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Okay. With an something like an 8 to 13 mile debris field, you had people reporting an mid-air explosion, you had eyewitnesses that saw basically a Navy warthog plane leaving the area, flying into the sun, so you couldn't watch it. Of these aircraft hit their designated targets. One hit the Pentagon, one hit the World Trade Center 1, one hit the World Trade Center 2. The other crashed over Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Okay. With an, it was something like recommended, because he was one of the first people to just have a military plane flying over the house here. I don't know if you can hear it.
Yeah, I hear it nice and loud. Oh, wow.
Nice and loud. Plane. Somebody's saying hi. Hi.
Nice.
But anyway, Mr. Christopher Boland was one of the first journalists to, like me, make the connection of, okay, if this is not how it's been sold to us, it's, you know, somebody is saying it was 19 Arab hijackers, you know, that's called a false flag, then who was it? And so there, you know, you go back to the who had the motive, who had the means, who had the opportunity, and most importantly, qui bono, who benefited. All right. So with me, at the time, you know, I was living the American dream. I had a very successful IT business. I was, you know, the CEO of my own company. I, you know, had, was married, had a house, had a farm, you know, had a political career. I was, you know, moving up through the chairs in my political party rapidly. Wow. And suddenly, you know, 9/11 happened. And it's the old saying, life comes at you fast. Suddenly, I found myself on the wrong end of a coup d'etat. And so on the anniversary of 9/11 in 2002, on September 11th, 2002, I posted an article called "We Are All Palestinians Now." And not only did I make the case that the most likely suspect for the 9/11 attacks was Israel.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's when I also came out and exposed the illegal electronic surveillance going on in the telco industry.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, I started getting the treatment, you know, as we call it, the treatment. And one of my last classes for global knowledge was with military intelligence, excuse me, naval intelligence in San Diego in early 2003, right before we were getting ready to go to a war on Iraq based on bogus cooked intelligence. You remember the yellow cake uranium stories and the weapons of mass destruction, which was all another fiction, just like the 19 Arab hijacker fiction based on these 40 phone calls. And basically, you know, called in on the Friday to get my itinerary for flying out on Sunday, so I could do my classes on Monday through the, you know, I was basically doing a 2-week class out there, and my account was locked up.
What account?
My account at Global Knowledge, where I would get my itinerary, my shipping information, my plane tickets, my hotel reservations, my rental car, my contact information, any security clearances I might need. You know, all of that was, you know, on my account on Global Knowledge's computers. And so I call tech services and they're like, "Oh, we're sorry, Mr. Blackburn. Oh, we'll, you know, check into this. We'll call you right back." Well, I got a call back a few minutes later and said very coldly, "Your account's been flagged and says you need to contact the Vice President of Instructor Services." And so I called the Vice President of Instructor Services and got this woman on the phone who very coldly said that my services would not be needed any further and they were canceling my contracts. And I had a 5-year contract with these people that had just been renewed.
Let me just stop you there. So you were giving courses or going to give courses to naval intelligence?
Right.
And when exactly was this? Was this in 2002 or 2003?
The last class I did was late, or excuse me, early 2003, right before the war in Iraq started.
Right. So
So
you had a
that.
contract with them, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, you were locked out and you were told your services were terminated.
Right. And this was also right after I had been told by the same vice president, as we were in meetings talking about developing new classes, especially remote training, internet classes, that I was one of the not only top rated, most liked instructors for the IT area, but for all of global knowledge. Right, so it's not like I was being hired because I or being fired because I wasn't doing my job. So I went from being one of their top instructors to my services are no longer required,
Who
and that they,
is Global Knowledge?
well, Global Knowledge is a private company that provides internet technology training all over the world.
Okay. And so
Yeah.
was it through Global Knowledge that you were also dealing with military NSA CIA?
Yes, because basically the way
Aha.
it works is we developed the classes and then sold them to the various clients. And, the clients may be a college somewhere. The client may be AT&T telephone. The client may be the FBI. And every client had a different need list. Part of the selling point of the way I had designed my classes were it was a module type buffet. So if I was dealing with sales guys, I could focus on that aspect more than the technical side. If I was dealing with troubleshooting tech support guys, we would deal with how to fix these things when they break. If I was dealing with people that were developers, it would be how do these things work? What do we need to design into this to be compliant? So I would have to change, and likewise with security, people, what are the security problems with these types of networks? And that's why I would work with the military intelligence, naval intelligence, NSA, CIA, et cetera. It's like, how do you go in and pick the information out of this stuff once you're authorized to do it?
So
Right?
let me just check with you. You had a security clearance?
Yes, I've had lots of security clearances in my life, up to top secret, especially when I was working for the Research Triangle Institute. I'd have to go into a lot of very secure areas. A lot of times, the areas I would go into, any equipment I would bring in, I would have to be, they would have to stay there and be destroyed. So I would go in with a brand new laptop. And do my presentation, and then they would have to, I couldn't leave the base with that laptop because it
Wow.
had gone,
Wow.
that kind of level.
They
So,
destroy your lap, they'll destroy your equipment to make sure that the information doesn't get out.
all right. And I mean, that was the
Wow.
layer levels I was playing.
So you had top secret clearance. From what years did you have top secret clearance?
Well, my first top secret clearance happened when I was at Research Triangle Institute in the mid to late 80s, about at 1987, because I had to get cleared to do my job there. Once I started working with Global Knowledge, basically it was a per job clearance where if I had a site like Naval Intelligence or Quantico or whatever, I would have to work with a representative there, and they would do a background check and vet me before I was allowed on the base. And I would have all of my IDs at the front gate of where I could go, where I couldn't go, that type of thing. So it's kind of like a per job type clearance, if that makes sense.
Yes, that's fine. Wow, so you had a lot of stuff. So you've dealt with NSA people, CIA people, FBI people, military intelligence, naval intelligence. So you've dealt with all the military intelligence services, more or less.
Yes.
So, did you tell any of them about about the phone calls being impossible.
Well, that was what was so hard after 9/11, because this is when you start getting into the aspects of the human psyche and what's known as cognitive dissonance and trauma-based programming. Once a person has gone through trauma-based programming, that worldview of that event is hard-coded, right, protected in their psyche. And anything that goes against that worldview is going to be dismissed. And that is where you run into, my mind is made up. Don't confuse me with the facts. And so I'm sitting there in these classes of the best and the brightest that America has to offer. And I'm trying very carefully to explain, this is physically impossible. I want you to understand that. And you could tell how uncomfortable the people were. And some people, especially people with a dog in the fight, would get out and out hostile towards me, especially one of the companies that people need to know about is a military contractor named called Booz Allen and Hamilton. And it's interesting how many people that were involved and associated with 9/11 ended up or came out of Booz Allen Hamilton. And I was doing classes for them because they were the ones writing the software for the NSA computers to use on this illegal electronic surveillance program. And so that was the only time a student got openly hostile towards me. And of course, he was Jewish and a dual Israeli citizen that was in that class at Booz Allen Hamilton.
What,
And
how?
apparently, I was getting too close to something he didn't want the rest of the students to know about. They are what's called a military contracting firm. And what military contracting firms do in the United States is they work directly with the military on various security level projects, from just basic general military stuff that's been declassified up through top secret level stuff.
Let me ask you this question. When did you start telling these people on these courses that those phone calls were impossible? More or less, when did you start doing that?
Well, it took me a few months, of absolutely verifying the data. And, right after 9/11, it was so hard to get good information because there was so much disinformation out there. But,
Yes. Or rather,
so
all
basically,
their propaganda blasting out of every place.
right. And so here, very carefully showing as I go through the mechanics of how a cell phone call is made to gently add in the distance factors, the speed factors, et cetera, the handoff signaling. And you could see just the tension in the room because people didn't want to see what we call the 600-pound gorilla in the room or the elephant in the room. And that's one of those, I don't know if is that a thing in South Africa? It's what we call an idiom of the elephant in the room or the 600-pound gorilla. It's like the obvious thing that nobody will acknowledge.
Yes, I'm aware of the elephant in the
Right.
room, big time.
Yes, the elephant in the room or the 600-pound gorilla. I say the 600-pound gorilla with a meanie beanie on. And so, that is where you really ran into the cognitive dissonance because these people were all pumped up, ready to go to war to get revenge over 9/11. And, that whole let's roll mentality was just permeating the military. It was just, the war drums were pounding. And like we always say, truth is the first casualty of war. And That's when I really started researching what's called the Overton window of your perceptions. And for your listeners that aren't familiar with the Overton window model, basically things move from something that's just completely unthinkable outside the realm of even to think about, that is so preposterous, to the radical view, to a sensible view, to a popular view, to the policy view. And so if the policy is 19 Muslim hijackers with box cutters infiltrated and outsmarted the largest military intelligence apparatus this planet has ever seen, masterminded by a guy in a cave with a laptop on a dialysis machine in Afghanistan. If you come in and say those phone calls are physically impossible and those buildings can't fall like that, we need to be looking elsewhere, you're not going to be a very popular person. And so that was, the problem with the 9/11 truth movement, was you most people, still believe that in the United States there is some law that says you have to tell the truth on television. You have to tell the truth on the radio. You have to tell the truth in a newspaper. And nothing could be further from the truth, especially with so many of the communication laws that got changed during the Clinton administration that basically made lying not only legal in media, but if a person working for the media refuses to lie, they could be fired and not have to be accountable. And the big test case there was with Fox News and the bovine hormone shots for beef production. And the journalist refused to lie, was fired. And when they tried to sue, the big ruling was that the company has the legal right to dictate policy of what is to be and not broadcast on their network.
Regardless, regardless of
regardless of
whether it's
truth or fact.
truth.
Exactly. And that was
Aha.
huge. And you look to see who was behind that law, and it's the usual suspects. These people are using what's called fourth generation asymmetrical warfare. And a big part of that is to corrupt the courts, corrupt the laws themselves. It's called legalese or lawfare. That you're manipulating the law. We saw this in the Soviet Union after the, during the Bolshevik Revolution, where they just flipped the law on its head. And so you've got the same usual suspects now in the United States putting all of these, players in position, people in position, to change the laws to their benefit so that, truth, we don't have to tell the truth anymore. And if you try to tell the truth, we can destroy you, and the courts and the police are going to back us up.
That's crazy.
Well,
Allowing companies to lie and it's fine. Oh man. That is
So,
huge. Yeah. Okay, so I've still got some questions for you. So you say that you gave, as far as I understood, two reasons why you said those cell phone calls were impossible. I can't remember the first one again properly. Oh, it had to do with the height. Had to do
Yeah,
with
it's
the
just,
height.
you are too far away from the cell phone tower to get signaling. And there are lots of YouTube videos out there of people taking a handful of every cell phone, you can imagine the top cell phones
No.
at the time up in small aircraft and showing that once you get to a certain altitude, even if you're right over the cell phone tower, you are not going to get signal. You cannot make calls.
Are you
So it's just
serious?
a
I've never come across YouTube videos like that.
Oh,
People
yeah. Well,
did
they would
that.
get censored. Yes. People said, this is the facts. You can't get a cell phone call to establish signaling because you're out of range. The second was
not
at the time, just the, you know, going from one cell phone tower to another because of the velocity of the plane. It would be like going down the road at, you know, 100 miles an hour trying to make a cell phone call. The second it got set up on one tower, it would be trying to hand off to the next tower.
Could the cell phone tower receive a cell phone call above its height, up to a degree, or not?
Well, you have some signal that goes up, but most of the signal, especially on those, you know, circa 2001 towers, the signals were going out because that's the target area. You're trying to blanket an area by going out, not up. But even with that, you know, you take a small plane, take a cell phone, fly right over that tower in circles, and after you get to a certain height, you're not going to have signal. And then if you look at the data of how high the altitude was on those planes on 9/11 per their data, you know, it's physically impossible. You know, you are above the threshold for you to be able to get signal.
If you're inside a building, that the building might have ability to handle cell phones?
You know, that is more of a shielding thing. It's like, you know, if you hear, for example, a lot of homes have metal roofs instead of asphalt shingle roofs or wooden shingle roofs, and you can't get cell phone inside the house because the metal roof is blocking the signal. So you have to go outside to make a cell phone call. In cities, one of the problems we had real early on was the way the cell phone signals would behave between the buildings, where you would have dead zones within a city because the cell phone tower signal just could not penetrate the way the buildings were arranged. And that was a problem, you know, with early, you know, second generation cell phone telephony and early third generation.
Okay.
You know, people would be riding around downtown trying to get signal, you know, and they couldn't get signal except for certain parts of a city.
Yeah, because I've still got my old cell phone from that time, and those cell phones were very primitive compared to now. So, okay,
right.
So, and the handover, was the handover able to function for people in cars?
That was one of the things. At that time, if you were going down an interstate, for example, and going, say, 60 miles an hour or whatever, at that time, the technology, you would probably drop the call because the handoff between towers wasn't sophisticated enough to be able to hand off to the next tower that you were driving towards. And so you would have to call the person again. And then when you got to the end of the range of that tower, the phone call would drop. You would have to make another phone call and, you know, try to hook with the next tower down the road. And this got really complicated when you had different people's towers. And this is what they call roaming charges back then, where, you know, if you went outside of our network, you were now roaming on somebody else's network, and it was much more expensive. And a lot of times it just wouldn't work. If you were, you know, moving into one area of a different service provider, your cell phone may just not work.
Okay. So even in a car, you were dropping calls. So if you were in a plane, unquestionably, even if you could get it, you'd have a real problem because the plane is going many times faster than the car.
Exactly.
Now, just another question. Cell phones, that's microwaves, and that's line of sight, hey?
As far, yeah, when you're modeling it, that's sort of how you look at it.
Is it not quite line of sight?
Well, you know, when I say, I guess it's the engineering persnickety. I mean, when I say true line of sight, I'm thinking like microwave dish to microwave dish, where it has to be completely, I can see you and there can be absolutely nothing around it because this signal is so much like a laser, it's not going to bend or wrap around. You know, you don't have any fuzz, so to speak. With cell phone towers, it's kind of like goes out in a cell pattern. It's like circle or spheres. And so yes, you do have, so that, you know, I can stand over here 3 feet and I get a little bit better signal. If I go the other way, I get less signal. So there's a little wiggle room in the way a cell phone tower bends versus some of these higher frequency true line of sight communications.
Okay, so the cell phone tower itself, in terms of sending out the microwaves, it's sending it out in all different directions, but those directions are still line of sight.
Pretty much, yes.
Okay. You
have a little wiggle room in there, but.
Okay, and they don't send out upwards. They only send out level and downwards. Okay.
Yeah, that was the, you know, you don't want to waste energy sending signal where you don't need it. So if you look at a cell phone tower, there are panels that are faced outward. You know, you don't see panels going up.
Okay. I'm going to take a much closer look at cell phone towers.
Oh, yeah.
Now that we've talked, because I just wanted to understand. So let me go and ask you, let me ask another question. You say that at a point, they then had to come back to tell a new lie and to say that the people were using sky phones. So are you saying that there was enough questions raised about cell phones that they had to come back to lie?
Exactly. And that was what the work of Dr. David Ray Griffin was so spot on about, was just keep challenging that narrative of the cell phone calls. And then they had to say, oh, well, they were made from the sky phones. And then we find out that those planes that the calls came from didn't have sky phones. And a person who did an excellent paper on this, which you can get on the internet, it's kind of hard to find, but it came out in 2010. And it's called Voices by Mr. Roland Morgan. So Voices by Roland Morgan, and that's R-O-W-L-A-N-D. Morgan is M-O-R-G-A-N. And he outlines all 40 calls, what the original story was, then how the FBI had to change the story, and then how that was proven to be a lie because they didn't have the sky phones. And then basically what happened at that point is the cell phones just disappeared from the narrative. If you notice, what? On all the 9/11, every year you have these 9/11 memorials where they revisit what happened on 9/11. Nobody talks about the cell phone calls anymore.
Are you
just like
serious?
Nobody talks. Seriously, it's just like nobody talks about the anthrax. I don't know if you're familiar with
I remember the anthrax. That I remember, right, as well. That was big. The anthrax sent.
Right. But once we proved that that particular strain of anthrax did not come from overseas, it came from Fort Detrick, Maryland, a U.S. military base, then suddenly, you know, after all those people like Stephen Hatfield had their lives destroyed, you know, nobody talks about the anthrax anymore. And what nobody ever talked about was a guy who was fired from that same facility for racist attacks on Arab co-workers. His name was Dr. Philip K. Zack.
Yeah.
And he was caught on security cam entering that security area after he had been fired. And of course, he is Jewish, and the woman who let him in was also Jewish. So he was working with her. The FBI never investigated that part of the story.
So a Jew attacked Muslims.
Right. And was fired for his race. He had a thing called the Camel Club there, which was basically, you know, they were just tormenting these Arab Muslim co-workers to try to run them off. They were just being that, you know, intransigent Jewish bully tormenting everybody they didn't like. And he got fired for it. And he was caught on security cam in that area. And that is where that strain of anthrax came from. Now, getting back to Booz Allen Hamilton, the same person from the FBI, a guy named Special Agent Dale Watson, he was in charge of the anthrax investigation. He was also in charge of the 9/11 investigation. And as a young special agent, he was an assistant investigator in the Oklahoma City bombing, if you're familiar with that.
Yes,
flag,
yes. That's very important. To me, the Oklahoma City bombing is almost like the other 9/11 of America.
It was the dry run for 9/11. It was the practice for 9/11. In so many ways, that same FBI agent, after he retired from the FBI, took an executive position at Booz Allen Hamilton. Another key person was Rabbi Dov Zakim, who was in charge of the Pentagon's accounts. Now, for a lot of people don't know that Donald Rumsfeld, the day before 9/11, announced that over $2.3 trillion, that's trillion with a T, was missing from the Pentagon accounts under Rabbi Dov Zakim's watch. It's interesting that if you look at the...
I didn't know that it was a Jewish rabbi in charge of the Pentagon. No, I didn't know who the person was. I know about the 2.3 trillion, but you said it was a Jewish rabbi.
Dov Zakim, Rabbi Dov Zakim, who's also an Israeli dual national, hardcore Zionist, hardcore Jewish supremacist. He went to work for Booz Allen Hamilton. Booz Allen Hamilton, you remember Edward Snowden?
Hold on. But when the plane, the so-called plane, hit the Pentagon, it killed almost everybody in the accounting office.
And he was conveniently not at work that day. How convenient, as we say.
Oh, man.
Just like Lucky Larry Silverstein at World Trade Center. Even, you know, disgraced U.S. Senator Al Franken in his book had to concede the point of what we call the Jew call. And these are his words. And that was the warning that so many high level Jews got on 9/11 not to go to work that day in those areas. And this was from an Israeli communication firm, another telecommunication company called Odigo. And, you know, even a disgraced U.S. senator in his own book had to acknowledge getting the Jew call about 9/11. So at minimum, Israel had foreknowledge of the event, like the dancing Israelis were there in position before the event. That applies foreknowledge of a conspiracy. That is against the law. You know, but what's also interesting about the Pentagon is if you look at the path, and again, accepting their data as true, if the plane or whatever it was came in with a straight line to the Pentagon, it would have taken out the majority of the top-ranking brass at the Pentagon. That would have been the key spot to hit strategically. Instead, whatever it was did this physically impossible corkscrew maneuver, 360 turn, and came in and took out the accounting department. So all the accounting that had the records of that missing $2.3 trillion and all the people who knew about what was going on conveniently got targeted that day. Wow. But they missed all the top-level brass. Again, who benefited?
Didn't that thing hit almost near the ground level?
So
it hit people who were on the ground level. So literally all the accounting people are dead.
And all the records destroyed, yes. Now, a woman by the name of April Gallup, she was working there and she survived. And her testimony is very curious in that she reported seeing computers not hit by anything, being destroyed, like they were bursting into flames, like they had thermite or something, you know, destroying that evidence. And it's very interesting to hear her accounts of 9/11.
Never,
as you know,
never heard of her. Who is she?
Yeah, April Gallop, Gallop, I believe. And she was a black officer, black woman. I'm trying to remember what branch of the military she was in, but she was one of the people who survived and tried to tell the truth and then started getting the treatment. And then sort of you didn't hear about it anymore.
Wow. A lot of these things that you're mentioning, I've not heard of. You know, I was familiar with the cell phone calls. That was a big thing. I mean, that was a big thing. And
it's huge.
At 10/11/2001, I was returning back from work from maternity leave. I had my son with me. I wanted to enroll him at the daycare at the Pentagon, but I received a call on my cell phone. They wanted me to come into the office and take care of a couple of things before I took him to the daycare. At the time, my first sergeant also let me know that she had to go to a meeting, so I was going to talk to her after she returned. Of course, I didn't think I was going to be able to get him clear to go back, you know, in the particular area, but for some kind of reason or circumstance, it was able to happen. As soon as I sat down at the computer, I put my son to my left in his stroller. As soon as I sat down at the computer, I went to turn the screen on, and when I pressed the button, boom. Things were dark. All of a sudden, I was covered from my neck all the way down. And debris, and I was laying on my stomach. My son, of course, was flown completely out of his stroller, and he too was covered under debris. When Elijah stopped crying, that's my son, he stopped crying, so I thought, you know, he was dead. And I knew that I had to do something to try to, you know, save him. At the same time, there were also other people who were there who were trapped in between the floors and in debris who were also making particular sounds, help me, save me. I got to get out of here. You heard screaming. You know, there was a lot of hysteria at that particular time. I was very split about what I should do, either try to find my son and get him out of here or try to help these people. I tried to, you know, reach down into the debris to see if I could find Elijah, but I wasn't able to do it. So then I helped the other people with the thought that, okay, you know, after I help them, help me. Find my son. And, you know, really there was no mythology to it. But on our way out, there was a large pile of debris. There were two individuals who were holding onto my arm. I reached down over, reached under, and I grabbed my son and I put him on my shoulder. And then as soon as we left that area, the rest of the stuff had collapsed. As I was coming out of the area, I didn't see any type of plane debris, no metal. No airplane seats, nothing that would cause me to believe that what had just happened was an actual plane hitting the building. Again, I wasn't on the outside, but from the inside view, you know, I didn't see anything that would give me any indication that a plane had hit and gone through the building. There was just nothing identifying that that had taken place. It was more like office equipment stuff, computers, books, papers, you know, desks, you know, things of that nature. Nothing metal or airplane seat or, you know, nothing like that. Nothing. No luggage, no bags. Nothing. As a matter of fact, I couldn't even find my own wallet. There were certain things that should have been able to be seen or identifiable as it pertains to the plane. When these computer screens were blown out, there were fires in that area of the computers, but it was just very smoky. But that's it. I wasn't covered in jet fuel. My child wasn't covered in jet fuel. The people that we helped get out in between the areas, they weren't covered in jet fuel. So I was located 1 Echo 517, first floor, E-ring, fifth corridor. That's how you read letters. It was the administrative office at that particular time, Office of the Secretary of the Army. I know they've changed their name, OAA, that I came out of the area where I believe it entered. I don't believe I came out of the area where plane was supposed to have exited. I don't believe, based off the pictures I've seen. I was told by the Pentagon renovation team I was maybe 35, 45 feet, give or take 3 or 5 feet, from the place of impact.
And I remember the anthrax and everyone panicking over the anthrax and the anthrax coming from here and there and running around for the anthrax. And so you're basically saying that the Jews were busy sending the anthrax using American anthrax. That's what you're saying?
That's what the evidence to me points to. And it's interesting when you look at the letters themselves. Remember that the whole point of, if we say that this was a false flag operation for Israel's benefit, there was a deliberate agenda to make the United States and Israel joined at the hips allies against this radical Islam to balkanize and fragment all the existing Arab countries. So if you look at the letters themselves, they all said death to America, death to Israel. All the countries they could have picked, they said instead, death to America, death to Israel, and Allah is great, right?
Right.
A gentleman who's from North Carolina, who's now living in Japan, Mr. Ryan Dawson, did some really good early. It's a little, rough production wise, but did some really good research and video work on the timeline of the anthrax, as you know, when the letters were mailed, when they were received, how the media ran with it. And it's all about, you know, setting up this image of Israel and the United States are in this together. So that's another factor that's interesting. Now, going back, once I asked the question of, if the official story is impossible, then, who did it? Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. Well, if you do a little research, you see that in 1982, an Israeli by the name of Odin Yenin wrote a paper called A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. This became known as the Odin Yenin Plan for Greater Israel, and it's all about balkanizing the Middle East for leaving Israel as the sole superpower. Then in 1986, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wrote a book, Terrorism, How the West Can Win, talking about preemptive warfare. And his work is based on Israeli game theorists. But basically this idea of, first strike type preemptive warfare. Then in 1996, Richard Perle wrote his book, A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm, which was basically fine-tuning Odin Yenin's work. In 1997, a Zionist think tank composed of all of these former Trotskyite Marxists, like Richard Perle and Douglas Fife, Bill Kristol, Irving Kristol, formed this think tank called the Project for the New American Century. And in 2000, they wrote a book exactly 1 year before 9/11 called Rebuilding America's Defenses, and it called for needing a new Pearl Harbor to launch their agenda. On 9/11, that was immediately branded the new Pearl Harbor. The number one Hollywood movie on 9/11 in the world then was the remake or the film Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
So you have all the psychological warfare going about Pearl Harbor, and suddenly 9/11 is branded and marketed as the new Pearl Harbor the reason why we need to go to war. And suddenly it's like, we're in Afghanistan. Why are we in Afghanistan? Why are we now going to Iraq? Why are we now going to Libya? Why are we going here, here, here? Why are we attacking Syria? And you look at these papers and it's like, that's because that's the plan. And even a U.S. general talks about General Clark, Wesley Clark. He was on a show here in the States called Democracy Now. And he talked about right after 9/11 visiting the Pentagon and being told that they're going to take out seven countries in 5 years. Right.
Okay.
And so it's like suddenly you realize the United States military has been hijacked for a foreign power's agenda, this world Zionist globalist agenda. And it's our military that has been designated to go fight it. And so suddenly it makes sense. You go back to who had the motive, who had the means, who had the opportunity, and who benefited, you know. Who else but Israel? And even on 9/11 that day, before the towers had even collapsed, you had, you know, dual Israeli national, but he was on all the major networks saying, oh, this has to be the work of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
Then you had Ehud Barak on the BBC saying the exact same thing. And if you go back a little bit earlier to the bombing of the USS Cole, that was when the American people were first introduced to this new boogeyman called Al-Qaeda and the mastermind of Osama bin Laden. And so that was like the seeding the story, the attack of the USS Cole was saying, oh, you've got an enemy here. Then this is a person who has dedicated his life to destroying America. So suddenly you got all of this propaganda about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Well, interesting that this FBI agent, Dale Watson, also assisted on that investigation along with the FBI agent that died that on his first day at work in the towers. I always tell people you can really understand the dynamics of 9/11 by the career of three FBI agents: John O'Neill, Robert Hansen, and Dale Watson. John O'Neill was the FBI agent who was probably the world's authority on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. He investigated the USS Cole. One of his complaints and the reasons for leaving the FBI was because his investigations kept getting thwarted by Jewish interests on the USS Cole investigation. Robert Hansen was an FBI agent that right as soon as George Bush and Dick Cheney took power in 2000 after the elections, or actually took power in 2001 after the 2000 election, suddenly there was this big to-do about throwing FBI agent Robert Hansen in a hole for treason, espionage type charges. And everything, of course, was classified. They just basically said he has betrayed America and they threw him in a solitary confinement hole. And Hollywood promptly started making all of these made-for-TV movies just demonizing the man as the worst person ever. And my take is that, you know, I would love to hear if he was the guy trying to warn everybody about what was going to happen on 9/11, because he got taken out before 9/11. And of course, Dale Watson was the person who did the non-investigation of Oklahoma City, the non-investigation of 9/11, the non-investigation of the USS Cole, and the non-investigation of the anthrax, who ended up at a nice job at Booz Allen Hamilton.
Right.
So
now you said one of them died.
John O'Neill, he was hired by World Trade Center security, and his first day at work. So this guy got hired by people like Larry Silverstein to do security for the 9/11 complex. And on his first day at work, he was killed in the attacks. The person I was talking about earlier that was on American television, it was Jerome Hauer. And that's J-E-R-O-M-E, last name Hauer, H-A-U-E-R. And he was the guy on all the American television stations before the towers had even fallen saying, this is Al-Qaeda, this is Osama bin Laden. Okay. He is the guy who hired FBI agent John O'Neill to do security on 9/11, and John O'Neill died that day.
Wow. How convenient. These people die conveniently, and the Jews live conveniently. I know all about Silverstein and his children, and they all lived.
Yes.
Oh, man. You know, and there's also something else. Wasn't there a World Trade Center 5 which had a whole bunch of gold in it, and the gold also disappeared?
Oh, you have to remember that there were several buildings in that complex, and they all got destroyed. And not only was the gold missing, and that's another little rabbit hole, but also all of the evidence that was in place for the Enron scandal. I don't know if you remember the big Enron scandal, but all of that evidence completely conveniently got destroyed as well that day. So all kinds of, you know, who does it benefit? Is it good for the Jews, as they always say? 9/11 was definitely good for the Jews.
Okay. You know what was another one that I found out about Oklahoma City that I only found out years later?
Yes.
And the thing that hit me there was I remember Ken Starr? Who was going after Bill Clinton. And I believe that all the evidence against Bill Clinton was in that building that was blown up in the Oklahoma City bombing.
As well as all the evidence about the Waco massacre, if you're familiar with the Waco massacre.
Oh, no. I know about the Waco massacre, but I didn't know that evidence is there as well. Oh, man.
Yes.
You know what?
So part of that first phase was to completely demonize and delegitimize the white patriot militia movement in the United States. You know, to demonize white men, especially the white militia groups. And so Timothy McVeigh became the poster child of what, you know, you're not supposed to be. Right. So that aspect of the, you know, the psychological warfare to demonize the militia movement. And, you know, Waco was a public relations nightmare for the Clinton administration. And that was the early days of the internet. But, you know, it was amazing to see how white Christians were completely demonized, especially white Christians with guns were completely demonized during that whole escapades. And you look and you see Jew after Jew after Jew, especially people like Janet Reno, things like that.
Yes.
Who was behind all this? And we see now that the Clinton administration was completely corrupt. It's always been corrupt, back to the MENA airport, the Iran-Contra Israeli scandal, where the guns for drugs scandal. Remember that? They called it Iran-Contra. Well, you know, when Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas, those drugs were being run at a MENA airport in the state of Arkansas. So, you know, this goes deep. This, you know, these people are playing the long game. That's what people don't understand, that this is a long game strategy.
Yeah, you see, the unbelievable thing about the USA is the level of the senior level of the people that must be involved in doing this. This is coming from people with unbelievable access to all kinds of things. Things that are way beyond what the normal person could ever, what your let's assume there was a white terrorist. It's way beyond what a normal white, let's look at a guy like Dylann Roof. You know, Dylann Roof with his little gun, and he goes and he shoots 9 people. He's like tiny compared to the kind of level that we're talking about for 9/11 and all the associated stuff. Like the other thing that was also mind-blowing was the work of that professor who did the work on the thermite specifically, but on the dust of 9/11. And he and another scientist tested it because they were looking to see whether this dust contained something that was explosive. And they found when they tested it that the explosive power of this material was even greater than military grade thermite. And you know, that tells you that it's somebody who's got access to unbelievable secret, top secret, super secret stuff. How the hell did they get their hands on that stuff? And
exactly. Dr. Stevens Jones was the researcher who did that paper.
Yes, Jones. Now, that stuff is unbelievable. And I must say, when I start looking at this military industrial complex, all these military contractors to the US government, the access to the secrets that they've got, these people are freaking dangerous. And the things and the things they can do and the scale on which they can do it. You know, because even just the putting of the thermite and other explosives that were needed to bring those buildings down, that in and of itself is enormous. And how many people would be required to put that stuff in those buildings? This is not something that's just done by one guy.
Exactly. And it's very interesting when you look at the career of Ehud Barak, who was prime minister of Israel, but then suddenly announced he was leaving politics to come to the United States. And the industries that he was working with here, it's very apparent that, you know, he was the point person for moving those military grade explosives and incendiaries like the super nano thermite and the thermate, getting all that in place for 9/11. And that's, you know, like I said, Ehud Barak, you know, he's one of the key masterminds and that people need to look at, because he was there handling the logistics on the state side.
You said thermite and thermate.
Yes, thermate has the sulfur in it as an additional oxidizer.
Okay, and what does thermate do? Is it stronger than thermite? Does it do the same thing?
It just more of the same. It's just more powerful. And then the, you know, what Dr. Jones was talking about in his paper was the nanothermite, that this is, you know, military grade, state of the art explosives that, you know, what is it doing? If the narrative is that this all happened by jet fuel, and it's like, you know, I challenge anybody to, you know, take gallons and gallons and gallons or liters and liters and liters of diesel fuel, jet fuel, and try to melt steel beams with it. Good luck with that, much less melting aluminum. But, you know, that you had pools of molten metal.
Yeah,
it's like how do you explain this? And you know, we saw the way the beams were cut with, you know, thermite charges, the cutter beams, also RDX, enhanced RDX. That's a specialty of Israel. They use it and they call them rag bombs. It's one of their preferred methods of blowing stuff up because it's just such a powerful, cheap explosive.
No,
And
never
yeah, these
heard
are
of
the
that.
things that,
Okay.
yes.
Wow, I'm just making some notes. Wow. We've covered a lot of topics, and you've mentioned, and initially I just wanted to talk about the phones, but these are very important topics, and I'm liking that we are going back over some of the old stuff that's already forgotten because of all the lying and all that sort of nonsense. So that is hectic. Wow, that is
Yes.
really hectic stuff. And
Right. And so, people really need to understand that 9/11 isn't just some historical event. 9/11 truth really matters. And I was one of the first people to sign on to Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, even though I'm not that type of engineer. So they
Oh,
had, two sections.
so you are a member of that group. 'Cause how is
Right.
that group doing? Aren't the Jews busy trying to destroy that group?
Oh, definitely. Right now they're ignoring them outrageously because they haven't gone away. They used to attack us during the Troll Wars.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how many people, have signed on to 9/11 Truth movement through Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Because the strategy there was brilliant from the beginning is, they weren't trying to prove who did it. They were just trying,
Yes.
or we were just trying to show that the official story is physically impossible. And
Yes, that was
that was
good.
the mission. And that's what we've done is, the official story as, written in that, the official 9/11 commission report, which came out, in July 22nd, 2004, that supposedly, was the big government investigation of what happened on 9/11, did not even mention World Trade Center 7, didn't even mention the physical impossibility of the cell phones, didn't mention the nanothermite found at the scene. It was complete whitewash. And then, of course, Popular Mechanics, of all people, put out this huge thing, and the media just said it was the final word on 9/11. But they, Popular Mechanics magazine, put out a thing called Debunking 9/11 Myths in 2006. And then you find out that the editor is Benjamin Chertoff, who is also Jewish and is cousins with Michael Chertoff, who was the person in charge of destroying all the evidence. All that metal got shipped to China before it could be analyzed, and he was also the one that got over 200 Israelis quietly deported back to Israel. That's the other thing people don't realize, that in
Oh,
the
tell
run
me.
up to on 9/11 and right after 9/11, over 200 Israelis were arrested in the United States, but were all returned to Israel quietly by Michael Chertoff. And this is an outrage. If you've ever seen the four-part series by Fox News on Israeli spying in the U.S. that came out in December of 2001, it talked about this, but then Fox News was forced to kill the story and remove it from their website. Fortunately, because of the internet, it still exists, but it talks about how the Israelis and these dual nationals had completely compromised the U.S. telecommunication system and were spying on Americans in the run-up to 9/11.
Wow, that is huge. That is huge. That is enormous, and that is very scary because the question that I ask myself is, what are the bastards doing now?
You're right. What's the next step?
And you know the one thing that I also like to try and tell people. People, whites turn around and they say, oh, well, the truth will come out, the truth will come out, and so forth. You don't understand the Jew. The Jew is going to come and invent a new lie, and a huge lie. And that lie is what he's going to use next. And
Exactly.
he's going to come at you with something. People are going to be fooled again. Whites are going to be fooled again. And a question I have for white people is, you might think that you've reached the point where maybe you understand about Jewish lies in the past. How many Jewish lies right now are you catching? How many of them are you catching now? How many of them are coming right by us and fooling us today? And I'll be honest with you, the more I study certain things and certain history, I'm telling you, I'm becoming more and more convinced that the only thing that's holding white people back and that's screwing us all up is just hundreds of years of Jewish lying. There's so much that's been lied about that we are not able to think straight anymore because almost everything has got some Jewish lie in it that's misleading us. And it's screwing us up as a race.
Yes, and then we were, you know, at what point do you move from lying to weaponized lying to full-blown psychological warfare designed to do what Pavlov called create induced neuroses?
I know about Pavlov and his dogs, but
right. Well, one of
what about the neuroses?
Well, everybody knows about Pavlov's work with ringing a bell and making the dog salivate, you know, the conditioned responses, conditioned to stimuli.
Right.
One of his, what they don't talk about is his work on deliberately driving dogs insane and under a paper called Induced Neuroses. And basically what he would do is a reward and punishment system where truth was associated with a circle. Falsehood was associated with an ellipse. And so the dogs were trained to differentiate between a circle and an ellipse. And if they got the truth right, you know, the circle, they got a reward, the ellipse, you know, that was punishment. But what he would do then is start changing points, the focal points of the ellipse to make it more and more circle. So the dogs were in this state of indeterminacy of not being able to differentiate from false to truth, and they were basically just self-destructing, and just howling and going insane. And you can find YouTube videos out showing this work that he did in the 1930s of how to induce neuroses just by showing, you know, A and not A, truth and not truth, and then blurring the lines. And as we learn more and more about this, you know, Jewish lies and, you know, how good they are and how much they control the media, and, you know, that we have white populations that are just self-destructing. White men in America's suicide rates are astronomical. And how many people in the United States and in Europe are on some sort of antidepressant, some kind of psychoactive drugs?
Yeah.
Because, you know, nothing makes sense to them anymore. Everything's, you know, messed up. And it's like, you know, well, where is that perception coming from? You know, how much psychological warfare is going on against us that has this ulterior motive?
No question. I've even observed this. I've even looked at white women, and I've come to the conclusion that a lot of white women, and I'm talking here in South Africa, a lot of white women have actually almost been mentally destroyed, but they aren't aware of it. But they've been almost mentally destroyed by all the different things coming at them. And you can see that. You know, when I think back to when I was a kid and how whites were, and even if I look at old stuff, if you look at old films and old photos of what whites used to be like a century ago, they were very, very different people and very happy, actually. Happy,
yes.
and confident. Happy and confident.
Hopeful.
And if you look at them now, you'll see women in South Africa massively overweight and everything, but they're not into feminism or anything. They still believe their sort of core values, but something is destroying them mentally. Something's harming their health. And exactly. I've come to the conclusion that whites are experiencing a level of sickness, and it all comes from the mind. And it starts with all this so-called liberal nonsense, but it gets deeper, and it's killing people. It's physically destroying people's lives. But there's one thing I see, and a thing that is a value right across the white race, a value that everybody has, and it's a natural value, is this thing called the truth. All white people draw the line at a thing called the truth. And they understand that if it's not true, then there's something wrong, that you've got to be dealing with the truth all the time. At a basic level, all white people accept this thing, even though they don't know what the truth is on many, many topics. But in and of themselves, when they can perceive this is a lie, that's the truth, they immediately rebel and they focus on the truth. It's a natural and a very critical value that we have as a race. And we whites take the truth more seriously than any other race. And if it wasn't for this focus on the truth, we wouldn't have science and engineering where it is today. And we as a race need to focus on that truth, come hell or high water, even if we have to die for the truth. But the truth
exactly
is everything. And whites hunting for the truth, I think that is a critical, critical thing. But watching what the Jews are doing in your country is just so shocking. It's out of this world. It's like a nightmare beyond belief.
Yes, it really is. And, you know, when you go back through history, and what is the main complaint about the Jews? It's always the Jews and their lies. You know, Martin Luther was talking about this. Henry Ford was talking about this. And then you look at the Frankfurt School from the 30s and read what people like Horkheimer and all those guys were talking about the truth, that there's no such thing as truth. Truth is totally subjective. Truth is anything we want it to be. And that total contempt for the truth permeates this cultural Marxist agenda.
Now, for me, when I look at what whites have achieved, everything we've achieved is based on the truth. And it is because we as a race focus on the truth that we are able to progress. I have watched the blacks, for example, who are not too concerned about the truth. It's not a big thing for them. And I watch how people are retarded when they don't go with the truth. So when I look at the Jew and his focus on lying, then that says to me the Jew is a force for destruction. He is anti-civilization. The Jews even have this proud thing that they talk about Jewish civilization. Jewish civilization is the ultimate oxymoron. There's no such thing. And they are not a people who've created civilization. They've destroyed everywhere they've gone. Their presence is a destructive presence. I think that, you know, somebody said to me, you know, this is a war between the light and the dark. And you really have to admit that that is one sort of spiritual aspect you can bring into this. You could say, truly, we whites are the people of the light, and the Jews are the people of the dark, and it's a war between us. And it's a no-holds-barred war, and it's a war that must be fought with the utmost energy and intensity, or else everything's going to go to hell.
And I would completely agree with that, because throughout history, you know, the Jewish model is the hidden hand. You know, go back and read the book of Daniel. You know, the hidden hand is that, you know, people that are not what they seem, the confederate, the spy, the saboteur, the assassin, the, you know, the star chamber justice systems. You know, this is all Jewish Talmudic thought. It is a completely different worldview than where Western civilization is at this point in our development. You know, so their idea of the, you know, Jewish supremacist perfect society is the antithesis of Western civilization, especially Christian Western civilization. And the, these Jewish writers say we have to destroy Western civilization and destroy white people for us to get our new world order. And, you know, they write about this.
Well, I must tell you, it's a war to the end, and whites need to understand the importance of this war. So, Frederick, it's been really awesome talking to you. Really awesome.
Always a pleasure, good sir.
And we went a lot longer than I expected, but it was very, very informative. I think we're going to have a bunch more discussions on various topics, but it's really good to bring all this stuff out, because 9/11 was just the other day, and already so much lying has gone on, and it's set the scene for the nasty world that we are in, and the destruction of these Arabs and Muslims for the benefit of Israel. This is a big topic. You know, before the Jews took over Israel, that whole region was quite peaceful. That entire region was completely peaceful. If you go and look at them, the breakdown of that region was when they were divided into groups by the British. But look at that region now. It's absolute mayhem. Yet for centuries, they were quite a peaceful people.
Yes, and you know, to me, that is the reality. And I always like the saying, we never had any enemies in the Middle East until we had a special friend in the Middle East, meaning that, you know, these problems started when President Harry Truman recognized the rogue state of Israel in 1948. And that is, you know, the demarcation point. You know, when did the Middle East start self-destructing? And you see whose hand is behind this.
Well, the thing I always point out is watch wherever the Jews live in number. There the blood is always busy flowing. When the Jews were here in number in South Africa was always on the front page of the world headlines, always South Africa, the focus of all kinds of things going from bad to worse. But I can see that the Jew being there in America, he's busy. He's busy tearing your country apart. And the the downside for the whites of America is that for maybe hundreds of years to come, there will be people who will hate America because of what the Jews did in America. But they will hate the whites. It's the whites who will bear the burden of hatred for things that were actually instigated by the Jew. That's the nasty thing.
And a case in point, our example there is, as a Southern gentleman, I really resent being labeled as a white supremacist descendant of slave owners, because that's the Southern stereotype. Knowing the reality was the majority of the plantations that had slaves, the majority of the slave markets in the United States, and the majority of the slave ships were all Jewish. Very few Christian families, especially in North Carolina, had slaves. They were opposed to it. And you know, the whole point of the Great Experiment was independent family-based living. You know, you don't see slaves on the Mayflower. for example. And, you know, but that is the thing, that we are condemned and our children are shamed in education systems like the schools and the media to make us take responsibility for things that weren't our fault. We didn't have the slave industry. We shut it down and bought it out. You know, same thing, you know, with, you know, Europe. You know, the Europeans were the ones who shut down slavery, and at great expense, because they had to buy the slaves from the Jews before the Jews would let go. But yet, you know, you listen to any Jewish professor and they're going to say, oh, those evil white people had all their black slaves, so black people should hate white people now and demand retribution, or, you know, reparations, and demand that debt that can never be paid.
Yeah,
yeah, that is the view.
The $1 trillion. Yes. Okay, Frederick, we've had a fantastic discussion. So I think we'll wind up 9/11 here, but I think we got other discussions coming. So if there are any other things you can remind the viewers of, where to find your work.
Yeah. And again, yeah, my name is Frederick C. Blackburn. I go by Blackbird 9. And on Wednesday nights, I host a show on Spreaker called Blackbird 9's Breakfast Club. It can be heard from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. The website is blackbird9tradingpost.org. Also, I have a Chatango chat room. People are welcome to come join. And that is bb9tradingpost.chatango.com. So bb9tradingpost.chatango.com. And Twitter, Gab, and Wrongthink, you can follow me on Blackbird9.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Frederick. It's been nice chatting to you.
Always a pleasure.